Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 27th of June. President Putin defends Russia's slow military response to the Wagner mutiny. He spoke hours after the Wagner boss, Yevgeny Prigozhin, released a defiant message of his own. Ukraine, meanwhile, says it's made more gains in its counter-offensive as President Zelensky visited the front line. And Israel's right-wing government approves plans for more than 5,000 new homes in Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. Also in the podcast, we look back at the life of the creator of the lithium battery, John Goodenough, who's died at the age of 100. And
I've witnessed myself people in a catatonic state that have been revitalized.
The Moroccan band who opened the Glastonbury Festival. As fighters from the Wagner Group drove towards Moscow on Saturday, there were reports that the Russian president had fled. In the end, the rebellion was called off before the mercenaries reached the capital. But Vladimir Putin's authority had already been seriously undermined. 2 days later, he's tried to get back on the front foot, meeting his security chiefs and making a short televised speech to the nation late on Monday. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford was listening to the address.
This was Vladimir Putin's attempt to reassert his authority, to squash any idea that his response to the Wagner mutiny was weak. So his tone in the short recorded address was furious, his lip curling. The message was that those who organized an insurrection had betrayed their country, and we're doing the work of all Russia's enemies by trying to drag it into bloodshed and division. He argued that his own decisiveness and skill in managing the crisis had averted disaster. Only that's not what many Russians saw play out over the weekend, so many won't be convinced by this performance. The president's talk of a country united behind him contrasts sharply with Saturday's images from Rostov, where the Wagner Group had taken control, and locals applauded fighters in the streets, hugging them and posing for selfies. That is probably why Mr. Putin offered Wagner members a way out, suggesting they'd been used and misled. He said nothing concrete, though, of his plans for Wagner's founder and the chief mutineer, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Today, he made his own audio address, full of more withering comments about Russia's defence ministry. It's not clear where he is now or what he does next, but he didn't sound like a man who felt defeated.
Sarah Rainsford. Well, those comments by Yevgeny Prigozhin were his first since he and his forces left Rostov-on-Don, the southern city they'd captured early on Saturday. In an 11-minute audio recording, he said the rebellion was an attempt to stop Wagner being disbanded. And he contrasted their swift advance towards Moscow with the failed attack on Kiev by the regular Russian armed forces last February.
After just one day, we only had 200 kilometres left to Moscow. We entered Rostov city and we took it fully under our control. It was peaceful and the civilians were happy to see us. We showed a demonstration, a masterclass of what the 24th of February of 2022 should have looked like. We did not aim to overthrow the existing regime, nor the legitimate power. We said that many times, and we turned back so that we would not spill the blood of Russian soldiers.
So what should we make of Yevgeny Prigozhin's speech? I asked Famil Ismailov from the BBC Russian service.
He's obviously had some time to think about what is happening and what's going to happen to him, what he was promised and what was the deal, and if he's won or he's lost during that deal. But he's obviously doubling down. His message is not just to his own fighters, also to the media that will be guessing what his next step's going to be, and also a message to people with whom he is not in direct communication, to show that he is still there, that he is still in charge of Wagner, and that he is not going to give up his fighters easily.
And what did he say about why he'd launched this insurrection?
The whole thing started at the point, as he says, when on one hand his relationship with the Minister of Defense of Russia and the Chief of General Staff, General Gerasimov, has become so bad that they probably decided it's time to think what we're going to do with Wagner. So the direct decision was that all Wagner fighters must sign up to the Ministry of Defense, the regular army forces, and they should sign contracts before the 1st of July. So the 1st of July would be the date when Prigozhin would lose the whole personal army. And he obviously didn't want that. So they decided to go, as he says, to Rostov-na-Don, where the southern command of Russian army and the headquarters from where the whole operation in Ukraine is conducted is situated. And they decided, as he said, to go there and submit the arms, that they refused to join the Minister of Defense. So here is our equipment. Goodbye. But on the way there, they were attacked, as he implies, and they decided to look for justice elsewhere. And that is in Moscow.
Famir Ismailov of the BBC Russian service. Well, despite the turmoil in Russia itself, the Wagner rebellion is not thought to have harmed Russian operations in Ukraine, at least not yet. The Ukrainian authorities said on Monday that they had captured more territory, while President Zelensky visited the front line in Donetsk. I got the details from our correspondent in Ukraine, Myeni Jones.
So the Ukrainian forces today say that they've recaptured the village of Rivnopil. It's just west of a small group of village that the Ukrainians had claimed to have recaptured in the very early stages of their counteroffensive, so about 3 weeks ago. And in social media footage that they've released, you can see Ukrainian soldiers in front of what looks like quite a dilapidated rural home waving the flag of Ukraine. Now, I think in and of itself, it seems like a pretty abandoned village, very much like the other villages, the other settlements that they claim to have recaptured so far. But I think it's part of a wider effort on part of the Ukrainian forces to send a message that despite what's happening in Russia, they're continuing with their counteroffensive. Their morale is high. President Zelensky's been saying all weekend, actually, what's happening in Russia serves it right. It shouldn't have occupied Ukraine, and now it's getting its just desserts. So I think this latest announcement is part of that message.
And also sending a message, President Zelensky himself, by visiting the front line, in contrast to President Putin, who many thought was hiding away over the weekend.
Absolutely. I mean, we've said it a number of times. This is as much a communications war as it is a physical one. And I think as much as Russia has been trying to project an image of strength, President Putin appearing on television today, the defense minister releasing a video of himself visiting his troops in the morning, on the Ukrainian side, they're very much doing the same thing. And by being on the front line, President Zelensky's done what he's done throughout this conflict, which is to show that he's close to his troops, he's involved, he's supporting them all the way. He's often seen wearing military fatigues himself or just a T-shirt. It's all part of that communication message, which is, you know, I am with my troops, I'm fighting with them, I refuse to leave the country, I won't take my family out. And I think it's significant as well that he went to Donetsk in the east of the country, which is one of the areas that's been more tightly contested with Russia, where the Ukrainians have admitted they've struggled to make as many gains as in the south and the southeast. So I think by going close to the Russian border, as close as he can at least, he's trying to send a message that we're continuing, we're pushing on.
Myeni Jones in Ukraine. And on his way home, President Zelensky released his nightly video address saying that his boys had advanced in all sectors. Our soldiers made advances. It is a happy day. May I wish our boys more such days. Well, the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania have watched Russia's invasion of Ukraine with growing concern. All three nations have sizable Russian-speaking minorities. On Monday, Germany offered to deploy 4,000 soldiers to Lithuania to strengthen NATO's eastern border. The German foreign minister, Boris Pistorius, made the announcement in the Lithuanian capital, Vilnius.
Germany is prepared to deploy a robust brigade in Lithuania on a permanent basis. We are talking about a brigade of around 4,000 soldiers, plus material, and if they are stationed permanently, families too. This involves considerable effort, and we have agreed that the growth of the brigade will follow step by step, so to speak, to follow the growth of the infrastructure.
I heard more from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Germany has headed the NATO battalion that's been in Lithuania since 2017. Basically, after Russia annexed Crimea and fomented the unrest in eastern Ukraine, and NATO reinforced its eastern flanks with four different battle groups, one in Lithuania, one in Estonia, Latvia and Poland. So Germany has already headed that, although many German soldiers are still continue to be based in Germany. And now what it's doing is saying, we'll make this permanent, but Lithuania has to provide barracks, facilities to hold exercises and warehouses, because 4,000 people is a considerable upping of the stakes. Chancellor Scholz announced last year that Germany was going to station this brigade. So it's not entirely new, but it's certainly moving to a more concrete phase.
And have we had reaction from Lithuania?
Yeah, Lithuania, unsurprisingly, it said it's stationing a permanent German force there is one of its priorities, and that it's expressed great gratitude to Germany for this. They're saying that they want this to happen as soon as possible and that they'll deliver the best possible quality infrastructure. It's moving forward. We don't know exactly when the first reinforcements will come.
And what about those other Balkan states, Estonia and Latvia?
Estonia and Latvia, again, as part of this NATO mission to reinforce its flank, are also moving up from battalion-sized battle groups to brigade-sized battle group. A brigade is in the region of 4,000. All battle groups differ in size according to the country involved. And NATO, since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, has increased the number of countries that host these battle groups. It added Romania, Slovakia, Hungary and Bulgaria to that group. So it's really trying to enforce the entire line from the Baltics down to the Black Sea.
Danny Eberhard, our Europe regional editor. Israel's nationalist religious government has approved plans for nearly 6,000 new homes in Jewish settlements in the West Bank, the Palestinian territory occupied by the Israelis. The US said it was deeply troubled by the move, which it sees as an obstacle to peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. Tensions are high in the West Bank following a wave of tit-for-tat violence. From Jerusalem, here's Yolande Nell.
According to the Israeli anti-settlement group Peace Now, the last 6 months have seen more than 13,000 settlement homes advanced in the West Bank. That's about three times as many as in the whole of last year. Settlements are seen as illegal under international law, although Israel disagrees. The new plans include an extra 1,000 homes in the settlement of Eli, announced by the government in response to last week's deadly shooting of settlers by Palestinian gunmen. Mobs of settlers went on the rampage in Palestinian villages after that attack. Homes were set on fire and one Palestinian was killed. Over the weekend, Israel's military police and Shin Bet security service chiefs issued an unusual joint statement condemning the vigilantism. Their move provoked an angry response from far-right members of the Israeli governing coalition.
Yolande Nell. Japan's Ministry of Defence has told the BBC it would be willing to shoot down any Chinese spy balloon spotted over its territory. Following the row over a Chinese balloon in US airspace earlier this year, a BBC investigation has found evidence of a suspected surveillance balloon over Japan in 2021. Our security correspondent Gordon Carrera has this report.
It was February when residents of the US state of Montana saw something strange in their skies.
8 Fox News alert now.
It's not a bird. It's not a plane.
There's a suspected Chinese spy balloon.
Chinese spy balloon hovering over the
Chinese
northern...
spy balloon.
The spy balloon was then spotted moving all the way across the U.S.
They're shooting it. That was like a missile that came out of that plane.
The balloon was eventually shot down, but its journey raised questions about the nature and reach of China's foreign surveillance operation. To find out more, BBC Panorama has been working with Corey Jaskolski, founder of an artificial intelligence company. The AI has been sifting through millions of satellite images to track the balloon's flight path.
Looking for something that's maybe 40 meters across, and we're looking for that in millions and millions and millions of square kilometers of Earth's surface.
The balloon was tracked passing close to a US nuclear base and all the way back to a probable launch site on Hainan Island in China. China claimed the balloon was a civilian airship used for scientific research such as meteorology and that it was an isolated event. But working with Corey, the BBC can now reveal new details about other spy balloons. Corey's AI program discovered 4 satellite images of a balloon crossing northern Japan in early September 2021. Yuko Murakami from Japan's Ministry of Defense told the BBC that they suspected that this was one of three Chinese spy balloons that has flown over their territory since 2019.
It is strongly presumed that the balloons were reconnaissance balloons flown by China. The Ministry of Defense of Japan is taking all precautions to monitor the situation on a daily basis.
Japan says it's prepared to shoot down Chinese balloons in the future.
For protecting lives and the property of people in the territory of Japan, it is possible to respond to that situation with the use of weapon.
The AI software also found evidence of another balloon off the coast of Taiwan. The Taiwanese government said it believed this was a weather balloon. The Chinese embassy says they respect all countries' sovereignty and territorial integrity. But John Culver, who worked in the CIA until 2020, says he believes China may be using balloons to intercept communications.
So if you're trying to pick up cell phone transmissions or understand communication patterns, then I could theoretically see where the balloon could be a useful platform for that.
Countries spy on each other all the time, but the very public nature of China's balloons flight has drawn new attention on the potential scale and ambition of China's surveillance program.
Our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Massive abuses here, which have cost the lives of probably thousands and if not tens of thousands. Satellite imagery in the absence of ground reporting, you can see dead bodies from space at the moment.
We have the latest on the dire situation in the Sudanese region of Darfur. The Indian Army says women activists have been blocking their efforts to tackle ethnic unrest in the northeastern state of Manipur. The military said such actions were harming their attempts to save lives and property. With the details, our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan.
It's an extraordinary statement by the Indian Army highlighting the complex ground situation in the eastern state of Manipur bordering Myanmar. More than 130 people have been killed and around 50,000 displaced in the violence between the Maithi and Kuki ethnic communities since May. The army has also released a video showing how hundreds of women blocking roads and arguing with security officials during operations. It has warned that blocking of security forces is not only unlawful, also detrimental to their efforts to restore peace. Over the weekend, a 1,000-strong mob led by women forced security forces to release 12 suspected rebels from a banned ethnic militant group. Army officials said they decided to hand over the rebels to a local leader to avoid violence. Clashes began in early May after moves to give tribal status to the dominant Maithis. That would have enabled the community to get quotas in government jobs and access to forest lands. But indigenous groups, like the Kukis, opposed the plan, saying it would deprive them of their access to forest lands. Both communities accuse each other of instigating violence. Internet access has been severely restricted to prevent further violence. The Hindu nationalist BJP government's efforts to bring peace between the communities have not been successful so far.
Anbarasan Netirajan reporting. 10 weeks into the military power struggle in Sudan, there has been heavy fighting in the south of the capital, Khartoum. The paramilitary rapid support forces, who have been battling the regular armed forces, say they've taken control of a police headquarters. There's also growing international concern about ethnically motivated attacks in the western region of Darfur, which has seen hundreds of thousands of people killed over the past two decades. Rob Young spoke to William Carter from the Norwegian Refugee Council, who is in Sudan.
We've got hundreds of staff around the country, and it's clearly a devastating situation, both in Khartoum, where there's been 3 months of airstrikes, pillaging, sexual violence, and then, as you mentioned, reports of large-scale and systematic killings in the expansive Darfur region as well, and also, you know, other military fronts opening up with different rebel groups in Darfur and in Kordofan area between Sudan and South Sudan. So we've had almost 3 million people displaced in the last 3 months, countless deaths and widespread destruction of infrastructure and homes. So it's a really chilling and deadly situation at the moment.
And as you try to help people, are your staff able to go out and about and give the help to the people who need it?
In some parts of the country, yes, we're here and we're scaling up. You know, we never left at the time, as did many NGOs and UN agencies. It is possible, but it's very difficult, especially to help people who have left Khartoum, a city that used to be, you know, almost 7 million people. So we're helping people who have fled their homes to slightly safer parts in the east and south of the country. But, you know, we've really been offline. We've not heard from some of our staff in the Darfur area. Communications have been cut. A few have escaped into Chad, just west of Sudan, and have some pretty horrific stories of what is happening at the moment there.
It does appear that the fighting is most fierce in Darfur. What are you hearing from your staff who have been able to communicate with you?
There's been mass murder, unfortunately. It has been a move for different ethnic groups to take control, different militias and rebels and paramilitaries there. It's completely lawless, total mayhem. So it's tough internally to help our staff, some of whom have got far fewer family members now than they did a month or two ago. It was a highly contested situation before. There was a peacekeeping mission, which was rolled up 2 or 3 years ago. It was protecting people, including these ethnic groups and displaced people. And now that's all gone away. And we see people completely vulnerable. And now we're suffering the consequences there.
The United Nations has said that the violence in Darfur has taken an ethnic dimension and could constitute crimes against humanity. Is it clear that one side, more than the other, is perpetrating these crimes?
It's definitely clear that there's an ethnic dimension in terms of the rhetoric used, in terms of the groups that are involved in what is happening. We're not investigators. This is complex, but it's clear that there's serious and massive abuses here, which have cost the lives of probably thousands and if not tens of thousands by now. There's different programs looking at satellite imagery in the absence of ground reporting, and you can see dead bodies from space at the moment. It is, as the UN is fairly cautiously describing at the moment, just that, but it's probably even worse.
William Carter talking to Rob Young. And on Monday evening, the Rapid Support Forces announced they would observe a unilateral ceasefire over the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha. In an audio recording, the RSF leader, Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, said the ceasefire would be in effect on Tuesday and Wednesday. A key suspect in a notorious racist murder of a black British teenager 30 years ago has been publicly named for the first time following a BBC investigation. Stephen Lawrence was stabbed by a gang of white men in southeast London in 1993. 5 killers were identified and 2 were eventually jailed for life. But police said there were, in fact, 6 attackers. The BBC's uncovered evidence showing that the 6th man was Matthew White, who died in 2021. Stephen's mother, Doreen, has described the revelations as infuriating and has called for serious sanctions against the Metropolitan Police. More details from Daniel de Simone, who led the BBC investigation.
The murder of 18-year-old Stephen Lawrence 30 years ago is the UK's most notorious racist killing. 5 prime suspects became infamous. 2 were eventually jailed. But police have consistently said there were 6 attackers. The BBC today named Matthew White, who died in 2021, as a suspect. For years, the Met classed him as a witness. The BBC investigation identified a series of failings by the force in its response to Matthew White. Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, oversees the Met.
I'm shocked, I'm angry, but if I'm frank, I'm not surprised. I mean, this family, the Lawrence family, have had to go through years and years of discovering yet further failings from the police service, deep institutional, racially driven failings, and today's yet another example of that.
The BBC found separate witnesses had said White admitted being present during the attack, his alibi was false, and the Met failed to realise he looked like the unidentified fair-haired attacker described by people who saw the stabbing. Retired Met detective Clive Driscoll brought 2 of Stephen Lawrence's killers to justice.
Based on the evidence, based on what we now know, you would have to consider Matthew White as the fair-haired attacker.
You know, I mean, short of a signed confession, I don't know what else you'd want, really.
The Met stopped actively investigating the murder of Stephen Lawrence 3 years ago. That remains the position today. But Neville Lawrence, Stephen's father, wants the case to be reopened.
I can't see why somebody would kill my son, because this boy was such a gentle and human being. There was more than two people who was at the scene and the night that they murdered my son. All of them should be in prison doing time.
In response to the BBC's findings, the Met has said sorry for its failings in the case and admitted a significant error which led to a key witness against Matthew White not being spoken to for 20 years. Prosecutors twice ruled out charging him, the Met said. Baroness Lawrence Stephen's mother said that apologies wouldn't give her justice and the failure to properly investigate a key murder suspect should be punished with serious sanctions.
Danielle de Simone. The creator of the lithium-ion battery, John Goodenough, has died in the United States at the age of 100. His invention of the rechargeable power pack ignited the revolution in portable electronics and electrical vehicles. Here's Electra Naismith.
John Goodenough's invention sparked the wireless revolution. It put smartphones, tablets and laptops into the hands of people worldwide. His discovery of cobalt oxide as the ideal cathode material for lithium batteries came in 1980 while he was teaching at Oxford. The university didn't patent it, meaning he never earned royalties, but it did win him a Nobel Chemistry Prize, albeit 39 years later and by then the oldest ever recipient. The Nobel Committee said John Goodenough had made possible a future where fossil fuels may no longer be needed.
Electra Naismith. A Belgian shot putter who competed in the 100 metres hurdles at an international competition over the weekend says she took one for the team but enjoyed every minute. Yolene Boumquo stepped in to prevent her country being disqualified at the European Team Championships in Poland. She finished the race in 32.81 seconds, 19 seconds after the winner. Rachel Burden and Rick Edwards asked her when she knew that her team's two hurdlers were out with injuries.
I knew it. Everyone knew it when we arrived at the hotel, when we had like the team meeting. So it was before my shot put competition. Mm-hmm. Every point counts in such kind of competitions. And yeah, I had something. Why not take one for the team? So that's why I didn't really think about it and I just went for it.
How did you approach it? And have you ever competed in the hurdles before?
Yes, when I was younger, I used to do some heptathlons just for fun because you have to be athletic as well if you're doing shot puts. It's important. So it was like 10 years ago when I did my last race in the hurdles. But now in my training schedules, I still do some hurdles just for the mobility to be flexible. But still doing it on an international championship, that's a whole new world. But I really enjoyed every second of it.
And just describe your technique for us.
At this moment, I also train with my coach in Belgium, Philippe Quinson. And yeah, he really learns me how to climb over the hurdles. Yeah, every hurdle I took and I was still alive, I was like, okay, I can do this. I went over the last one, a kick of adrenaline rushed to my body and I just ran over the, how do you say?
The line.
Over the finish line.
Yeah, the line.
and the crowd loved it.
Yeah, it was really heartwarming. All the support, the crowd who were screaming. Yeah, I can't even believe it today. How many people are so kind?
Belgian shot putter and hurdler Yolene Boumquo. Well, much of the hype surrounding the Glastonbury Festival over the past few days was about Elton John's final ever UK show, history was also made by a group of performers from North Africa. For hundreds of years, the master musicians of Djuka have handed down their unique sounds of drums and pipes to the next generation in their local village in northern Morocco. But on Friday, they had the honour of opening one of the biggest open-air music events in the world, as Richard Hamilton reports.
I'm making my way to the pyramid stage at Glastonbury, and obviously you can hear the drums and the pipes of the master musicians of Djuka. They normally play, the last time I saw them was 4 years ago in their local village, where they play in front of a select and fairly elite audience of 50 people, and they're here where Glastonbury has 200,000.
Yeah.
The contrast between playing in their remote home village in the Rift Mountains, which until a few years ago had no electricity, and on the pyramid stage at Glastonbury was an enormous culture shock for some of the musicians. Two of them, including Mohamed El-Mejdoubi, had never actually left Jujuka before.
It was wonderful for us to perform in front of so many fans, better than in Morocco. Here we saw many wonderful fans. For us, it was the first time we've been outside Morocco, and it was amazing. A shock, yes, but amazing.
Ricky Steen has been a tour manager for the Master Musicians and organised their performance at Glastonbury. He first took 27 of them around Europe in 1980 on an old bus that kept breaking down. He says this ancient spiritual music helps heal psychological suffering, working as a type of therapy.
I've witnessed myself people in a catatonic state that have been revitalized. And people come and have been coming from miles around, from all the valleys around, if they have any ailment of heart or spirit, to experience this.
But while there were 27 musicians in the 1980s, there are now only 11. Many of them are elderly, and it's not clear if a new generation will emerge. This age-old music, thought to date back to at least the 16th century, may be facing its final curtain. But perhaps the story doesn't end there, and Glastonbury will help revive their fortunes.
Richard Hamilton reporting. And that is all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast very soon. This one was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.